You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 2nd of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Today we're taking a trip to the theatres of New York, courtesy of our good friend Matt Wolf.
We'll also get some recommendations from the German DJ and producer Chantel, one of the world's leading figures in globally inspired dance music.
I wanted to set up a situation where everything is a bit more minimalistic. These days, when you're in a studio, you know, it looks like a spaceship, you know, many knobs, buttons, everything.
And we'll be asking Bloomberg's art market correspondent, Scott Rayburn, what he made of this year's FIAC Art Fair in Paris.
Plus some advice for the weekend from San Francisco, a peek at the reading list of one of Brazil's leading literary critics, and our take on the Karine Reutfeldt documentary, Mademoiselle C.
While the documentary stands out for its bold editing choices, harsh back-to-back cuts of fashion shows, glimpses of backstage scenes, and the occasional porno chic reference, it lacks overall coherence.
So plenty of opinion and debate to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
How has your cultural week been, Gillian DeBias?
My cultural week's been good, but my highlight was actually the week before when I was in New York for the book launch tour, and I escaped to have a hard hat tour of the new Queen's Museum that's going to reopen in Flushing Meadows.
I mean, we've got to look back at what this building was. It was the New York World Art Fair, World Fair in 1939-1940.
I mean, I have to say, I mean, the art, I'm sure, will be wonderful, but I just had goosebumps because of the history of that building. It was the home of the 1939 World's Fair, but then it was also the home of the United Nations when it first formed. And from 1946 to 1950, that's where all the world leaders would come. All the biggest decisions were made. And it has a very heady history. And then, of course, in 1964, it was once again the home of the World's Fair. And still has the Unisphere, that famous Unisphere from the 1964 World's Fair.
And it's now the Queen's Museum of Art.
Yes, it's one of kind of Bloomberg's sort of legacy projects, and it is it's been revamped, but with a strong focus on bringing in local contemporary artists from the area. And I don't mean, you know, graffiti artists and sort of yard sale artists, but really some of the really good artists from the area that should have a bigger stage and beautifully architecturally designed, but keeping those original features. So you will not be able to go in there without feeling its heady history. But what about you, Miss Nelson? What about your cultural week?
It was up there with yours.
Tell me more.
I saw Cloudy with Meatballs too.
Lovely.
And it was... I won't explain why, but I ended up in one of those very sickly sweet smelling movie theatres, which all you can really smell is you're overwhelmed by three things. Firstly, is the smell of sugary sweet popcorn and stuff like that. Secondly, is a little chattering of voices, and thirdly, is the constant kicking on the back of your seat by the person behind you who is generally under 5 foot tall. And gets bored. And it was all right as far as kids'
taking
films go.
Children to the movies.
I found myself scowling halfway through and I sort of told myself off for it. It is okay. It is a very inventive little film in terms of the subject matter. I won't bore you with too many of the details, but it's an inventor and he has to go and rescue an island which is populated by living cheeseburgers and talking strawberries and cucumbers that like
to
fish for sardines.
I'm with you there.
It has beautiful moments of surrealism for that very reason. You have this wonderful scene where a bunch of dill pickles love to spend nothing but an afternoon fishing for sardines in the sea. All these animated animals that have been sort of made out of food is a very, very nice little premise. The story, you and I could, you know, whip it up in the back on the back of an envelope in about 5 minutes' time. But I suppose that's what you want if you're under 10.
I'll go make sure I book my ticket.
I was about
now.
To say, yeah, I'll take you later because it's obviously worth a second viewing.
We're going to begin the show, indeed, with a special focus on the fall season of Broadway. As usual, there are no shortage of revivals.
There's no shortage of new material, too, including more productions showing music. Our man in the stalls is theatre critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolf. I'm sorry for getting the name of your newly named old paper wrong.
It's all right. I answer to anything.
I'm quite
really? We'll try it.
And I shall refrain from calling it In It. Oh, dear, I've just done that. How is New York? How's Broadway doing in autumn, or should I more precisely say fall?
Well, in New York, we do say fall. And in fact, the New York Times makes a big fetish each year of its fall preview issue, which comes out the first Sunday, I think it is, in September. And it's always a great read because whatever the shows end up being like, the fall preview issue sets the pulse racing because everything looks like it's going to be fantastic. And then we just wait to see whether the things actually are or not. This is a very busy fall. In recent years, producers have been waiting till winter, particularly spring, because they want their shows to open later so they can win Tony Awards because, in America, the only thing we really care about is awards. But for some reason, this fall, they're throwing awards concerns to the winds and just having a busy, active season.
Well, I was frustrated because I was in New York just before you were.
Yes.
Everything sold out. You gave me my little crib sheet of what to see. I could not get tickets for any of the sparkling productions that were on your hit list. What was your highlight?
Well, there were a couple of highlights off Broadway, and it's important to remember that, of course, Broadway is, I suppose, the glittering epicenter. But off Broadway is sometimes every bit as vibrant and active, if not more so. And off Broadway is having a very good season. There's a lovely musical by the woman who did Shrek, speaking of Cloudy with Meatballs 2. But when she's not doing things like Shrek, she does very adult shows. It's a musical called Fun Home, based on a graphic novel by a writer named Alison Bechdel about the growing up of a lesbian daughter whose father, she discovers later in her life, was a closet homosexual. And it's a very interesting story. The part of the daughter is played by three different women at different points in the daughter's life, including a very young girl who's about 6 or 7, who's absolutely terrific. And it's painful, very funny. The title is interesting because the fun in Fun Home actually is an abbreviation for funeral, because what the father does is work in a funeral parlor. Mm. So
sounds promisingly bleak. There's no...
We love bleak.
We do love bleak. There's an awful lot of bleak on Broadway.
Bring on the bleak.
Let's start off with the glamorous couple of Hollywood, Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz, husband and wife, off stage and on stage in possibly about as bleak as you can get until the next play that we're just about to review. Pinter's The Betrayal.
Well, and I don't mean this at all facetiously, but my problem with this production, quite frankly, of a play I absolutely love, was that it wasn't bleak enough. Mm. This is the 7th or 8th time I've seen the play. It's done in London all the time. Pretty much every major London theatre at some point or other has done it. Kristin Scott Thomas did it beautifully on the West End 2 summers ago. It's got a very painful core to it because it's about the loss of everything in it. And this production, for much of the time, not all the time, is played like a romp. Daniel Craig is the husband of Rachel Weisz in the play, who's having an affair with his best friend, Jerry, played by Rafe Spall. And what happens is that their crumbling marriage and the failed affair is charted backwards across 9 scenes and also 9 years. And so you begin at the end, as it were, and end at the beginning. And what Mike Nichols, the veteran stage and screen director who's won something like 10 Tony Awards, what he's done with this show is, I think, not really trust the New York audience to get Pinter as Pinter. So everything's kind of over-embellished. The lover, for instance, is played as kind of a buffoon and a bit of a joker. The sex scenes, such as they are, whereas in the play, it's a touch, it's a caress. Here, it's sort of full-on, bedroom, full-throttle heat, which weirdly is less sexy.
It's such a British play, such a British Pinter play. Do you think in a way they were trying to pump up the volume on the Britishness of it, but, no need to?
Yeah, I mean, the irony is this is the 3rd Broadway production of Betrayal that there have been. It's also the 1st Broadway production of Betrayal to have any Brits in the cast. The other 2 didn't have any Brits. They were all Americans, or in one case, Juliette Binoche, who's French. And in a way, it's the least authentic. However, and this is a very important however, Daniel Craig is absolutely terrific as the sort of pent-up husband who says at one point to his wife that actually it might have been better if he'd had an affair with his best friend as opposed to her. And he's got absolutely that kind of clenched, barely held terror, really, that courses beneath a lot of Pinter, and also that animalistic sexuality, which is important to this play.
He does have a good face for Pinter, actually. That it's a sort of a very hard, sort of crunched up face. It's hiding an awful lot of trouble. Rachel Weisz, on the other hand, is a consummately stylish and beautiful actress. Do you think that is possibly she's a little bit too beautiful, a little bit too stylish?
I really love Rachel Weisz as an actress, and she was wonderful in London a couple of years ago as Blanche DuPont's Streetcar Named Desire, and you don't get more challenging than that. Her problem in this is that I don't think she's been helped by Mike Nichols as far as what to reveal and what not to reveal about a character who is divided pretty much all the way through between husband, lover, and her own sense of guilt, shame, and all of that. She's also preposterously, and this may sound like a niggling detail, but it's true, she's preposterously overly costumed by the costume designer Anne Roth, so that in every one of the nine scenes, she's not in every one, but every scene that she's in, she looks like she's on her way to the Oscars. And this is a woman who runs an art gallery in London, probably does very well, but she doesn't need to be quite so casual glam. And again, I think that's the director and the production not trusting the audience to just take the material at face value.
That is Betrayal on Broadway, but you can't get a ticket for love nor money. Let's move on to a revival of another great play to do with sort of frustration and sort of the intoxication of not being able to get what you want. Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie. Let's have a listen to a little bit of it.
The idea of getting a gentleman caller for my sister Laura began to play a more and more important part in my mother's calculations. It became an obsession.
My devotion has made me a witch, so I make myself hateful to my children. I worry so much. I don't sleep nights. It makes me nervous.
Mother, you know that Laura is very different. There are a lot of boys who meet girls which they don't marry.
An excerpt of Tennessee Williams' 1944 play, The Glass Menagerie. Matt Wolff, is it as claustrophobic and as awfully brilliant watch as it should be?
It's such a beautiful play. I could see The Glass Menagerie once a week for the rest of my life and be a very happy man. It's sort of a perfect jewel of a play. It's one set, four characters in an infinite emotional landscape. So it's all there. I've seen it many, many times. This is one of the most beautiful looking productions. And I don't mean beautiful glamorous. I mean beautiful in its interpretive approach. Bob Crowley, the Irish designer who's based in London, has sort of surrounded the stage in a kind of inky blackness. And there's a sort of sea of, it looks like water, but it's probably some kind of oil that reflects the moonlight. So it looks as if the Wingfield family in St. Louis, where the play is set, are in this kind of strange existential void. And John Tiffany, English, who directed it, does all sorts of interesting things, which I really shouldn't give away, but there's the crucial role of the young daughter, Laura, who's crippled, and the way she enters and exits the play, I will never forget. Let me just say, she doesn't walk on and walk off. It's something very different. It's a huge hit in New York, I think partly because, of course, New York loves this play, loves Tennessee Williams. Also because Zachary Quinto, who's very popular from Star Trek, and, you know, there are a lot of Trekkies around, is playing the son, Tom, who is Tennessee Williams' version of himself. And it's a very pained portrait of a man who will never find peace. It's a memory play. He's looking back at a definingly bleak episode in his life with his mother and his sister who, in Tennessee Williams' sister in real life, had a lobotomy. It was the most tragic story. And you get the sense in this that he's condemned to rehearse this again and again forever.
It is a work of, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, to borrow another title. But how can it be kept relevant for it was written in 1944. How can it be relevant now? How can it keeping the heart pounding?
Well, I think what John Tiffany has tried to do is find connections to the emotional landscape of any family at any time in any situation. I mean, St. Louis, Missouri is a place that, trust me, most New York audiences have never been to, much less elsewhere in the world. But this is a microcosm that works as a macrocosm. So it works on every level. He also has a movement director, Stephen Hoggett, who he worked with on the musical Once, who has, it doesn't have song and dance numbers, obviously that wouldn't be appropriate, but it has sort of choreographed bits where you feel the rituals of this family and how empty they are and also how fraught they are. So a lot of imagination has been brought to bear on a play about the imagination.
You mentioned Song and Dance there. We shall leave the Glass Menagerie and move to After Midnight, a story which the critics have been describing as explosive, sexy, steamy, 1920s Harlem.
Well, After Midnight is the perfect, what they used to call, you don't hear this phrase anymore, but they used to have a Broadway genre for the tired businessman musical. This was, you know,
I wasn't expecting that.
The end of the day, and he says, "Oh, honey, you know, I don't want to go to the theater." And the hard put upon wife says, "Well, how about a show where you don't have to think?" And he says, "I'm there." So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be a very lucrative thing. And this show is the latest in a time-honored American genre. And if you want to go to the theater and hear songs like "I've Got the World on a String," "Bragging in Brass," "I Can't Give You Anything But Love," it's basically a trawl through the golden oldies of Harlem, as you say, from the 1920s. And it's got an absolutely crackerjack onstage orchestra who've been handpicked by Wynton Marsalis. And just to listen to them going hell for leather with the brass and the percussion is pretty dazzling.
But I think we have a little clip of the making of it. Let's have a quick listen.
I love the fact that people of all ages will have a chance to experience the greatness of Duke Ellington's music and understand his music is timeless. It's a part of our legacy. To a younger person, this is a part of your heritage too.
The blues, jazz, it all started there. I grew up on that. I'm just gonna be honored to be up on the stage. I want to do my best. I want to step into, you know, this time and actually really go there and live it.
There's going to be more wow-type things that you'll see in an hour and a half than you'll see in anything else. It's such a diverse cast, so many different people who are great at the various things that they do.
I defy your toes not to tap. Matt Wolf, we have but 10 seconds. Would you sum up if we had just one evening? Which one?
A Glass Menagerie, but if you're jet-lagged and tired and really zonked, After Midnight will perk you up.
And you brought one playbill ill that we don't have time to talk about, but just tell us the name and what it's about.
It's a great title, Bad Jews, see the show.
Enough said. Matt Wolf from Init, the International New York Times. I really must stop doing that. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Review.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson.
We turn now to Monocle's team of editors, producers and correspondents to get their opinion on a recent release, opening or publication. Today it's the turn of our producer Daphne Denis, who's here to give us her take on the documentary Mademoiselle C. The film, directed by Fabien Constant, follows former Vogue Paris editor-in-chief Karine Reutfeldt to New York as she attempts to set up her own magazine. So what did Daphne make of this new contender to the September issue?
She loves fashion, she lives for fashion, she breathes fashion. She's a neoclassic, but at the same time, she's punk.
It's a woman of a vision, stylish, thoughtful, and loving.
Je suis une rebelle, je fais pas des photos, je raconte des histoires.
She knows what she wants, she has a vision, and she states the vision.
Je suis parisienne, et je pense que ça se ressent dans mon style et dans le style de mes photos.
It's difficult not to compare Mademoiselle C, the documentary on Karine Reutfeldt, former head of French Vogue, to the September issue, RJ Cutler's dramatic behind-the-scenes look at American Vogue, and Reutfeldt's transatlantic counterpart, Anna Wintour.
Anna Wintour's office.
Is anyone coming for this run through except for me?
We're gonna go!
I'm with the internationally renowned editor-in-chief of American Vogue, Anna Wintour.
Both films follow the making of a magazine issue, the iconic September edition of Vogue US in One, the first installment of CR Fashion Book, the print venture Reutfeldt embarked on after being pushed out of Condé Nast, in the other. Both depict women that have become muses to fashion designers, trendsetters, and businesswomen. both aim to portray their protagonist's unique creative vision and show the nuts and bolts of running a fashion publication. Yet while the September issue truly presents what happens in the making of Vogue, the good, yes, but the bad and the ugly fights with Grace Coddington too, Mademoiselle C falls prey to its director's fascination for his subject. In his defense, Fabien Constant makes it obvious from the start that his film is a love letter to Mademoiselle. And granted, Rotfeld is a much nicer version of Wintour. Her liveliness, enthusiasm, and irresistible French accent truly shine throughout the piece. The problem is, the narrative arc suffers from its author's complacency towards anything Karine-related. Rotfeld's fallout with Condé Nast, arguably the most interesting aspect of the whole story, is merely evoked in passing as a small bump on her perfect road to success. The few editorial meetings that are filmed generally reflect how difficult it is to build a magazine from scratch, to the point where they feel staged. And while the documentary stands out for its bold editing choices, harsh back-to-back cuts of fashion shows, glimpses of backstage scenes, and the occasional porno chic reference, it lacks overall coherence.
Julia, she has
oh,
a baby.
Yes.
Can you imagine?
No.
No? Me too.
At the end of the film, Rotfeld says it would be sad if people got bored of her, with a shy smile, then laughs the idea of. And she's right. Mademoiselle C, the woman, has enough charm and character to keep the public interested. Sadly, the same cannot be said about Mademoiselle C, the film. For Monocle, I'm Daphne Denis.
Thank you, Daphne. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Time now to find out what's happening in the world of music. This week there was a special guest passing through London who we just couldn't miss. Someone who's constantly one step ahead of the curve when it comes to the world of globally inspired dance music.
German DJ and producer Chantal is a name known around the world as a purveyor of forward-thinking club music, with roots stretching back into swing, gypsy jazz, klezmer and calypso mixed with modern production techniques. He was in London this week and sat down with Paul Noble to talk through some music giving him inspiration.
I do love music a lot. It's part of my life. And of course, I'm grown up with so many different kinds of influences and styles. And I was very involved into the electronica scene. And touring around the world, one day, I think it was something like 10 years ago, I ended up in Chernivtsi, Bukovina, which is now Ukraine. And I found the house of my grandparents.
Right.
And I stayed there something like 2 weeks, you know, and it was a very touching experience. Came back to Western Germany, and, you know, my whole, let's say, idea of creating music changed a lot. So I started, like, mixing my own family roots, my own, let's say, identity with, you know, Eastern Europe influences, with Western digital electronic influences. And, you know, we created this so-called Balkan pop movement. Mm-hmm. And later on, you know, there was more swing and more, you know, other influences. Music is something that it's not, you can't hold the idea, you know, it just created a self-dynamic, and then it's fantastic, you know, to be part of it.
And that was something which, when you started making it, the idea of mixing sort of Eastern European folk music and klezmer with modern house production techniques, that was something quite fresh and new, which now seems to have really exploded, and you'll hear a lot of that in the charts even.
Yes, I mean, I didn't even think about it to create something, to make a big success out of it. I mean, I have a deep passion, you know, it's really part of my identity, of my, let's say, I feel like that. And I had the idea, if I will do this. And it's a kind of adventure, because it's always, let's say, difficult to work with something which is maybe more historic, more traditional. I mean, you don't even want to touch it, you know. I'm full with respect for this material, which is maybe 200-300 years old or even older. And anyhow, I mean, I tried to do it very well in the way how I could provide and, you know, just create something unique. And luckily, it went all around the world.
Yeah, really did. Well, let's get into some of your music now. You've picked a few tunes to play for us today. What's your first pick?
I would love to start with the Ethiopians, which is yeah, it's an old school reggae from Trojan Records. And, you know, the Ethiopians is a, it became a soundtrack while traveling. You know, we spend hours in planes, in trains, in cars. And you need something you just where you can park your brain. I was never like a big reggae fan, but you know, Ethiopians, they always bring something spiritual to me, and I love it. Talking about Africa.
Okay, so that was the first music pick of our guest, Chantel. That was No Baptism by the Ethiopians, some rock steady out of Jamaica. Very nice. When you talk about travelling, is this, are you travelling with a group? Because also you DJ. What's your sort of live setup when you take your show on the road?
Actually, I'm doing both. We are a kind of wandering circus. It became like that over the years. In between, I do a lot of DJ sessions. And, you know, as a matter of fact, there are some promoters, for example, you got invitations somewhere in Azerbaijan, you know, and they don't really have an idea, okay, what is the band about? What is it all about it? I mean, we know it's a kind of, you know, fancy entertainment program, but, you know, we don't know you guys. So sometimes they invite me first as a DJ and then...
Give them a taste and
exactly.
You come back with the band.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your new album, Anarchy and Romance. What was the... Because you've moved away from the sound that people might traditionally associate you with.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the people who knows my work, they always have this... I mean, if they experience my work in a way, I'm always experimenting, you know? And if there is something... I worked on a style and then I need to make always a step forward, you know. I don't want to stick in a success. Yeah, I don't want to, let's say, just repeat myself on and on and on. You know, Anarchy and Romance, for me, it's a project where the first time ever in my life I tried to create something really, really alive. You know, I normally did like... concept albums. Disco Partizani was a concept album. I was a producer with a computer. Of course, I did a lot of live recordings, but I've spent weeks behind the screen creating the album. And Anarchy and Romance was the first time I went to the studio. I was in Hansa Studio in Berlin.
Which is a very famous studio. So for those that don't know, who's recorded there? What albums have come out?
David Bowie was there, Iggy Pop, even U2 worked in Hansa Studio. It's close to Potsdamer Platz.
Right.
In the middle of the old West Berlin.
So you got a big musical legacy.
Exactly. And it's like an oasis, this place. Mm-hmm. And I loved working there. And, you know, I brought the band over there. And then we did sessions. We recorded the sessions. And then, you know, after 2 days, we had almost the whole album set up. And then there was more fine-tuning. But, you know, the main idea was to create something really, you know... alive, you know, you can hear the instruments and not so much production, you know, specialities and, you know, just to make it more down to earth.
All right, let's hear a track from it. Which one do you want to pick?
I think we should start with Letkis, A Touch of Beauty, which it's a kind of schmaltz, grotesque song.
All the beauties wearing fancy dresses. They put a spell on me.
Mm-hmm.
So a touch of schmaltz grotesque. We've just invented a new genre here.
Yeah.
That's from Anarchy and Romance, from Chantel. And so in your press release, you talk about the one particular microphone that you used all of this. Is this right? You used just one microphone to record the whole album?
Exactly. I used a very old ribbon mic. You can see it sometimes on the record cover, on the vinyl covers of Frank Sinatra. I mean, they use it for big band recordings. It's a huge one. And I mean, this microphone is very unique. I wanted to set up, let's say, a situation where everything is a bit more minimalistic. These days, when you're in a studio, you know, it looks like a spaceship, you know, many knobs, buttons, everything.
Yeah.
And of course, the computer is the main, the key instrument these days. And I went like 50 years backwards in a way. I don't know. It was more like, I really want to do music, you know, how they did it in the past, in the old days. I mean.
And you want to feel like a musician and not a computer programmer sitting there looking at a screen.
Yes, exactly. That was the main idea. And, you know, it's all this analog stuff. I think there is a big renaissance. You know, thinking about vintage clothes, you know. Even the music, we have to put soul back into the music. And, you know, if you work with this, let's say, stuff, microphones and compression, you know, the tube compressor, stuff like that, it has something. You know, it gives something warm, you know, atmosphere.
Well, you can definitely hear it on the album. Let's go for your third music track.
Yeah, the next one is called All the Glamour Has Gone, which is much more disco. You know, I love disco. I still love partying. And, okay, if you listen to my album, it's always that I need one track which is somehow kicking. And now the Glamour Has Gone describes a little bit the fast-changing situation of about daily living, you know, we are into. I mean, like, things are happening, informations are short, you know, and has to be reduced to main issues. And we get a little bit lost. You know, we have our smartphones, computers everywhere in the underground, whatever, and we're a bit lost.
The Glamour Has Gone from Anarchy and Romance by Chantel. We're going to have to wrap it up here. Just very briefly, you're out on the road now. Where will people find you? You're in the middle of a big tour.
First of all, I'm really looking forward for our show 12th of December here in London at Electric Brixton.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, tomorrow we go back to Berlin, and then I play a show in Istanbul. So we are all around the continent. Some things will come up, Mexico City, Canada, Italy, of course. So, you know, it's a road movie.
And this is the full tour with the Bukovina Club Orchestra.
Exactly.
Wunderbar. Chantel, thank you very much. Good to meet you.
Dankeschön.
Bitte schön, Chantel. That was a German DJ and producer Chantel talking to Paul Noble here on The Review.
Time now for our weekly focus on the best one city has to offer in terms of art and culture. If you find yourself at a loose end in San Francisco, then take heart. Here's Alistair G to guide you through the weekend.
Strike the pose. First up this week in San Francisco is Fall Into Vogue, which describes itself as an old-school style voguing and runway competition and takes place Sunday night at Beatbox. You can watch Madonna's Vogue video to get a sense of what's required. And if you want to compete, there are three categories: butch, femme, and freak la chic. The top prize in each is $100.
In California, say, I used to work on a morning
Then in the afternoon it got very hot and sunny, so I'd go and lie on the beach.
Running during the week and for several more months, a must-see is the new David Hockney show at the De Young Museum. It is the first major survey of the artist's 21st century work and includes images of Yorkshire as well as of Iceland, Norway and California's Yosemite National Park. From Wednesday, several theatres are playing host to the San Francisco International South Asian Film Festival, with over 20 films from the subcontinent and North America. Some of the more intriguing selections include Ship of Theseus, in which the story of a blind photographer who regains her vision but loses her artistic ability is interwoven with other narratives, and Mohammed Tamaya, a documentary that follows a man named Mohammed as he travels to Singapore to have gender reassignment surgery.
When I told my brother I'm going to Thailand, he's like, what, you're going for sex? Like, what do you mean? What's that supposed to mean? I said, well, people go for, you know, they go to Amsterdam for drugs and they go to Thailand for sex. I said, that's brilliant. I said, yes, that is exactly what I'm going for. The only thing is he missed a word, sex change.
Coming in the Golden Gate, and we were arriving in the country of freedom and everything. And I said to the sailors, I want to live there. And I pointed to Alcatraz because it was so central. And they said, oh no, you have to kill somebody to live there.
This week, it's also worth checking out Mark de Souvero's open air exhibition at Crissy Field in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge. De Souvero's enormous steel sculptures echo the bridge's design. Finally, keep November 15th open because authors Simon Rich and Farley Katz will be on hand to present their new book, The Married Kama Sutra, the world's least erotic sex manual. The writers, who have both worked for The New Yorker, offer a humorous, illustrated guide to married life. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
A very erotically minded Alistair G there. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment with a roundup of last week's FIAC Art Fair in Paris and a look at the best literature from the Lusophone world, so stay with us.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. And every week in London, there's a rollerblading convoy that reclaims the streets for the pedestrians and pedal pushers. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
To me, placemaking is a sacred community process. It's about an organic way that communities can evolve and shape the spaces that are important to them.
Every 20 years, the city gets rebuilt. There's probably not a lot of cities in the world that get rebuilt every 20 years.
People respond to variety, and cities need a richness and diversity.
Oh, and we take time to savour the softer side of metropolitan living too, from the need for playfulness to places to pause in the melee. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias. A moment ago, we were in San Francisco with Alistair G. Now we stay in the Americas for our next review, but this time south of the equator.
Feel like taking a peek at the books on the bedside table of a literary critic? Well, Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter went to meet essayist and literary critic Federico Coelho to get a feel for what's on his reading list.
I'm reading right now a novel, a Spanish author called Agustin Fernandez Malo, and the novel is Nocilla Dream. And people are saying that now, after this book, they have the Nocilla generation in Spanish. So I have to read that because I have to know about what kind of generation is that. And I'm very, very connected with some North American author called David Foster Wallace. He died, like, he committed suicide, I think, some years ago, you know. And now we have these books about his literature. One Brazilian company called Companhia das Letras, they are launching all his books. And he was, like, completely unknown in Brazil, maybe 5, 6 years before. I'm really delightful with his style, because he's a very, very smart guy and a very philosophical guy, but at the same time, he's very funny and acid about critical point of view from American society. So I'm reading his novels, I'm reading his interviews, and I'm waiting for his amazing romance called Infinite Jest. Like, people saying that has like 1,200 pages now. So I'm waiting for that to be like 5 years reading David Foster Wallace. And there's also some Brazilian authors. One of them, it calls Bernardo Carvalho, and his novel it calls Reproduction, Reprodução. And it's very cool because he's a very intellectual author, you know, working with some narrative structures. But in this one, he just is writing like a very conservative and reactionary guy from internet, you know? The guy who's made this kind of completely amazing commentaries on websites, you know, and newspaper websites, always complaining about the society and Brazilian society. And it's a very funny to read this kind of author working in this totally different literature work, you know, kind of work. And this is the three books that I'm reading right now.
When was Reproduction released, and how relevant is it right now to everything that's happening here in Brazil at the moment?
It released like this year, no, maybe 3-4 months ago, and there's no big critic about this book because it's very new. But at the same time, people are talking about this book because it's a very different style from this author, and he's a very important author today in Brazil. From the last 20 years Brazilian literature, he's a kind of classic one. Because this recent protest in Brazil, it's kind of synthesis about what's going on in Brazil for last years, you know? And Bernardo Carvalho, maybe he's watching this kind of very conservative opinion it's surrounding all the political system in Brazil, the idea that the poor people has to be working or in jail, you know? The idea that politics from the left wings are almost like the robbers of the whole nation, you know? And there's a kind of danger feeling that there's no way to Brazil besides criminalization of poor people, you know.
What is an upcoming book that would be released that you're looking forward to?
There's a Brazilian author called Tatiana Sanin Levy. She released it like maybe 5-6 years ago, a very, very good novel called A Chave de Casa. And do we have any translation for the English version, I think?
Would that be Key to the House?
Yeah. And this book is amazing. And she's working in a new one, but I'm waiting for her new novel, because I read about what is the motive, you know, the subject, and I thought it was very interesting. The story is about there's an island in Brazilian in the north of Brazil, a very small one in Maranhão, the state, right? And this island, it's fully of albino. It's just a albino population in the whole island, and they're kind of cult. Her novel is about that. It's about some plot surrounding this island, so I'm very curious about it.
That was the Brazilian literary critic Frederico Coelho talking to Sheena Rossiter in Rio de Janeiro.
Let's turn our attention now to art and to the hyper-competitive nature of the international art market. Hot on the heels of Frieze in London last week, Paris staged its annual contemporary art fair known as FIAC.
In recent years, London, Hong Kong and New York have somewhat stolen Paris's thunder as a global centre for art. But with the recent opening of François Pinault's La Conciergerie and Larry Gagosian's massive art hangar near Le Bourget Airport, is the City of Light staging a comeback?
Well, Scott Rayburn, London-based art market correspondent for Bloomberg, joins us now in studio to report back on the business done at FIAC this year and to give us his take on Paris's contemporary art market credentials. Welcome to the studio, Scott.
Hello.
So tell me, because, you know, we had Frieze here in London and then Paris lifts its curtain on its own contemporary art fair. How did Paris do?
Well, the thing is, collectors these days, they're time poor, they may be very wealthy, and they're having increasingly to make decisions about which art fair to go. And I felt quite strongly, and a lot of dealers are saying that rich collectors were choosing between Paris and London. Mm. The problem with Frieze Week this year was that it was just so incredibly overcrowded. 10 art fairs, probably the same number of auctions, limitless gallery shows. And a lot of people were saying that it was just impossible for people to focus on things. And if you can't focus on things, it's actually quite difficult to spend money. The thing about FIAC is it's in one place, in the Grand Palais. It's not in a tent in Regent's Park.
It's a nicer place.
Oh, it's a superb venue. Now, in the past, Paris has a reputation, the contemporary art scene isn't as funky, isn't as lively, isn't as dynamic in London. But now there are some good dealers. As you mentioned, Pinot has been putting on some major exhibitions. And also FIAC is getting together increasingly good quality dealers. And arguably the best piece shown over the 2 weeks in London and Paris was this amazing Ai Weiwei sculpture called Iron Tree, which is made casts of bits of wood that he found in the mountains of southern China. And he constructed this amazing life-size tree out of cast iron. And it looked absolutely magnificent under the cast iron roof of the Grand Palais. And it was just a knockout piece. That was €1 million and at least one of them sold during the fair.
It looks, I mean, it sounds absolutely beautiful. Mm. The whole point of Frieze this year, what struck me about Frieze this year was the international element of the dealers who were there.
Mm.
Yes, okay, London, listen, was everybody was represented in full throttle. But you got an awful lot of Brazilian dealers, and obviously New York was there as well.
Mm.
To what degree did the French prefer to keep things a little bit more French?
Well, queuing up for the sort of the VIPs going into the fair, FIAC talks about how international it's becoming, but actually I pretty well only heard French voices. but it is becoming more international. And in a slight sense, the sort of elephant in the room is that when people are choosing between London and Paris, they're making a lifestyle choice between where they want to visit. And increasingly, people really like going to Paris. It still has this draw. And, you know, these great cities are being sort of hollowed out to become playgrounds for the rich. And a lot of people like going to Paris.
So you work with Bloomberg Art Market analyst. Where's the money? Where would you put your money on? What are the emerging regions? What did you notice was kind of surprising you in terms of where money was
spent? Well, the hottest name of all at the moment is a guy called Oscar Murillo, who's interesting. He's got a studio based in Dalston. He's was born in Colombia. 3 years ago, his paintings were selling for about $2,000. In September, they reached $401,000 at auction. He's been picked up by these key collectors called Dom and Mira Rubel in Miami. And once the Rubels pick up an artist, then all other collectors have to have an example.
And what makes him, what stands him out from the rest?
He looks a bit like Jean-Michel Basquiat, which is great. So that's a head start. And he paints large abstracts that are smeared with studio dirt and food. They have a grittiness that appeals to international wealthy collectors. There's a sort of urban element to appear that attracts. And there's also this sense that he is the new Basquiat, and Basquiat is a sort of gold standard. And he's very prolific, and he's making huge amounts of money at the moment. At Frieze, one of them on the booth in the primary market sold for $120,000. So there's a big waiting list.
It's strange that you mention the likes of Oscar Murillo, whose meteoric rise is being catalogued by pretty much everybody. But just looking at what the director of FIAC said, Jennifer Flay, said, she said, newness is not our baseline. I mean, ouch, when it comes to what she's saying to Frieze. That's a nice little pink poke between the lips. What do you think she means by that?
Well, there are two elements to this. Wealthy collectors want to buy the new thing, the next best big thing, you know, the new Hearst. And they'll spend $3,000, $5,000, $10,000. They'll buy at that level. But they also want to be reassured by big ticket post-war works of art that give us a fair sort of gravitas. And that FIAC has, you see, partly because of the tradition, it's in Paris in this magnificent building, but there are dealers who deal in early 20th century art, 20th century art, and that gives the whole fair weight, intellectual weight. That's why Frieze Masters actually was started, is to give Frieze, which was starting to look a little bit stale and frivolous, some intellectual and critical weight with older works.
It's interesting, the hype around an art fair. And in a way, perhaps London has had too much publicity. So instead of buyers, you start getting gawkers, people who feel they have to see and be seen, people without the money in their checkbooks. What is the difference, say, between an art market like FIAC and the auction houses? Like, do the wealthy, serious buyers go to the auction houses and the people who like the social life buy at art fairs? How does that differ?
Well, there's a paradox here, because you think, well, the art fairs are full of rubberneckers, but it costs 25 quid to go to Frieze. It's an enormous amount of money. Mm. If you go to the auctions, you can look at this stuff for free at the View. It's actually quite a sort of secret free museum that not enough people know about.
Plenty of people know, because I'm quite a fan of doing this.
Yeah,
so
don't
tell anybody.
Oh, Scott. I mean, what I always find astonishing with the art fairs is that these are not... What is wonderful and exciting about an auction is it is a one-off moment when something comes on the market and then it goes away again. But art fairs themselves are effectively just everybody's shop.
Exactly.
In the same place. And so I wonder why those who want to go searching out... I mean, is it just because it's the equivalent... It just becomes the hyper-supermarket? People can just hoover up what they want, where they want. I mean, it was astonishing the number of Russians just wandering around Frieze, going, I want that one, that one, that one, that one, that one.
Well, I write about the art market, and essentially I'm writing about the shopping habits of people who don't pay much tax. these are supermarkets, these places. And also, you know, it fills time. If you're very wealthy and you haven't got much to do, it's a great way of spending your life. It's just wandering around the world, going to art fairs, and you go to wonderful parties. You don't have to pay for anything.
That's why I thought the plasma of Larry Gagosian's big hangar gallery near Le Bourget, where all the private jets come in, I thought was no coincidence.
No, absolutely. I don't really know how that space is working, but you will never find out, because he never ever discusses sales.
But is this the future, though? The entirely enclosed art market, which of course we all know exists, but to almost set up a new network for the art market. Is that where you see it going?
Well, to me, it's just a separate reality, really. Even when I go to Frieze, when I leave the fair, I sit in a playground for half an hour to be in a sort of decompression chamber just to see some human beings leading ordinary lives. Because it is such a strange,
surreal,
artificial environment.
And other emerging art markets we should know about?
Well, as you perhaps discussed, there was the Africa Art Fair 2 weeks ago, which was actually the most enjoyable of all fairs to go to, because it didn't actually look like an art fair, because it was it was in Somerset House, and the dealers each had their own sort of stately Georgian room overlooking the courtyard with the fountains, and everything was at a very low price level, and you just discovered a lot of new artists and a lot of new regions producing interesting stuff.
Scott Raeburn, thank you very much indeed. That was Scott Raeburn, London-based art market correspondent for Bloomberg. With that, we bring a close to our weekly review. So goodbye from us here at Midori House. And thank you for listening. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa, and it was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
Georgina Godwin is back in the studio now to continue with our weekend programming with The Curator, Monocle's best of radio show, which presents some of the unmissable highlights from the week that was on Monocle 24.
But for now, you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.